I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A pollster took a look at today's new Wall Street Journal NBC News poll and renamed the upcoming midterm elections the JetBlue elections. Everyone hurling invective and heading for the emergency exit. Voters do seem to be as disgruntled as that flight attendant. According to the poll, nearly two-thirds think the economy has yet to hit bottom. The country is also growing more pessimistic about the war in Afghanistan. And not exactly breaking news, approval numbers for both parties are at or near record lows. And it seems the more Americans know about the Tea Party, the less they like them as well. Peter Walston is national politics correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. And Peter, since the Obama administration took office, they've been warning that recovery from the housing crash and the ability to wind down two wars would take time. So what to you is it that's so important about this snapshot of America?
Well, it's true they've been saying that it was going to take a long time to recover, but they've also been saying that things are slowly improving and that there is evidence that things are getting better. And they're talking about the stimulus bill and they talk about the auto companies. And they've been telling reporters all for the past several months that once the economy starts to turn around and voters acknowledge that, then they will start to grow more supportive of the Democrats' agenda. Unfortunately for the Democrats, what we've seen in this new Wall Street Journal NBC News poll is that the voters are not growing more optimistic. In fact, they're growing more pessimistic. And that number, the two-thirds of people who think the economy hasn't yet hit the bottom, that's a big increase in that number. That in January, that was just slightly more than half of Americans who thought it hadn't hit bottom yet.
And the economic news yesterday and today is very disappointing. A jump in foreclosure rates is being reported today, a six-month high in the number of newly laid off workers, and the stock market's, you know, been dropping on the news. But you also point out that the president isn't getting any props for the things he has done, like helping to rescue the car industry. People just aren't feeling it.
No, we asked the question in a number of different ways, and voters are just not ready to give the president or, frankly, Congress credit for anything. A clear majority says that this Congress has performed way below average or is even one of the worst Congresses ever, and the president has not met expectations on a range of issues. He's fallen short of expectations, even on health care, on regulating Wall Street. Those are two of the huge legislative achievements that the White House wants to take credit for, but the voters are giving them no credit.
Well, but the Republicans fare even worse in some ways. They have the worst favorability ratings in 21 years of your poll, the Wall Street poll. But more Americans think that they would do a better job on the economy.
That's right. And again, these are it's all relative. People are really down on the Republicans, but they benefit from simply being the opposition party right now. The Democrats are the party in power, and they're the ones with the targets on their backs. So even though the voters are dissatisfied with both, a little bit more dissatisfied or disapproving of the Republican Party in general, the Republicans are just kind of sitting there as the beneficiaries of all of this voter angst.
More Americans know about the Tea Party movement, but they have a higher negative than they've ever had. But what else jumps out at you, Peter Walston?
Well, on the Tea Party front, it's interesting. You know, you would think that with all of this voter discontent with both parties, there might be room for a third-party candidate. Our poll shows that there really isn't. The Tea Party is out there. Their negatives are higher than they've been. When we ask folks if they'd be willing to vote for the Tea Party, a majority, 53%, says, well, we know about the Tea Party, but we have no interest in voting for anybody affiliated with the Tea Party. Our pollsters think that the Tea Party is more and more becoming just another way to describe the kind of conservative base of the Republican Party.
A couple last things. Pakistan, it has the worst negative rating of anything people were polled about. On the other hand, Michelle Obama, the best. I mean, she's just got a tremendous favorability rating. And yet we understand that the White House is debating whether or not to send her out on the trail.
Yeah, she's the most popular. She's got, half of Americans feel positively about her. Only 19% feel negatively. She's far more popular than either of the political parties, the Tea Party movement, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid. She's more popular than the president. Despite this trip to Spain, which happened, our poll was in the field while a lot of these stories were coming out, she would definitely be an asset for them, especially in Democratic areas.
That's Peter Walston, a national politics correspondent for The Wall Street Journal on their latest poll conducted with NBC. Peter, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, we want to spend some time now on a tough, tough subject, drowning. Or as the Boston Globe put it chillingly in a recent headline, how we drown. Drownings are rare, but just this summer, in two separate instances here in Massachusetts, two sets of twin girls drowned in backyard pools. All four of them drowned. Six teenagers from two families drowned during a family gathering in Louisiana. Last weekend, four grown men drowned in Idaho while on an outing on a boat with their kids. And according to government statistics, two children a day drown, one a day in a pool. Well, Francesco Pia says one problem is we're looking for the wrong warning signs. As a lifeguard in New York's crowded Orchard Beach back in the 60s, he was filming a simulated drowning to teach other lifeguards when he caught a real drowning and rescue on film. He decided to hire a college student to film for several summers, and that led to the groundbreaking film, The Reasons People Drown.
These two children are drowning. Their parents are only 10 feet away. And until I rescued the young boy and girl, their parents thought they were playing in the water. They were shocked because their children were drowning and didn't call out for help.
Francesco Pia changed the way rescuers think about drowning, and he joins us now from the studios of WFUV in New York. And Francesco, you and fellow lifeguards rescued upwards of 2,000 people every summer at Orchard Beach. Take us back. What was the accepted wisdom then, and why did you decide to question it?
I recall my own feelings of anxiety when I first started working as a lifeguard at Orchard Beach. Essentially, it was on-the-job training. You sat on the chair with a senior guard. He would identify a drowning person, point, and then just toss you off the chair at that person. And drowning was described as convulsive agitation that advertised the fact that the person was drowning. And the recognition of the drowning person was thought to be self-evident.
And this was reinforced by films that we saw and television shows. People who drowned flailed their arms around and waved at you and yelled, "Help!"
That is correct. That was the popular conception, which is really a misconception.
And what'd you find?
Well, I found a number of rather fascinating bits of data. We learned at Orchard Beach not to expect the people to call out for help or to wave for help. That is a myth. Also, it was very clear that in nearly all the drownings and near drownings and rescues that we captured that summer, and there were several hundred of them, it was the rule rather than the exception that there were people surrounding the drowning person that did not realize the drowning was occurring.
Because why? Because people get actually quiet?
Well, they were expecting that when a person is in an emergency situation, typically they will call out for help. Drowning, by definition, is suffocation in the water. They're not able to get enough air in to continue breathing, so speech doesn't come into play.
There is a physical activity, though, and you came up with the phrase, the instinctive drowning response, sort of flapping arms out to the side and trying to push up and down vertically, more like climbing a ladder.
I asked myself the question, what is the drowning person trying to accomplish? Since they can't float, since they're drowning, by definition, they can't swim, so they can't tread water and kick their legs. The only limbs that are left are the arms. In an attempt to use the water as a solid platform that they can press down on in order to lift their mouth out of the water in order to continue to breathe. Whether persons we were rescuing were males or females, children or adults, whether they were old or young, once they got into water above their head, this instinctive response occurred.
Well, and so you found that people who are drowning most often do so quietly? One of the most disturbing things to read was that you had film of a little 12-year-old boy, his eyes tracking someone, you know, swimming by him, but he's not able to speak. But also, you found it happened so quickly. How quickly?
The struggle of the drowning person ranges from 20 seconds to 60 seconds. So in the case of the 20-second struggle, there was a parent who was taking his 2- or 3-year-old child and was about to step off the drop. We whistled him in. He kind of just waved us off. He stepped off the shelf. His instinctive drowning response kicked in. The lifeguards had already started their rescue as this man was walking off the shelf. So I was able to look down at my watch to calculate the amount of time that the child struggled. 20 seconds, which is the shortest period of time. that I observed before he submerged and the lifeguard reached him at the point of submersion. The 60-second struggle occurred where a young adolescent male, he was about 200 yards away from the nearest lifeguard stand. So we saw him run down the beach. It was low tide. We just knew that he was going to be in trouble very shortly. Again, I hit the timer on my watch. The lifeguard took off. This young man struggled, and at 60 seconds, he went down, and the lifeguard grabbed him. So it's that window of time that's important for lifeguards to realize.
Well, and with children in particular, there's also a bewilderment. Dr. Julie Gilchrist, who's with the CDC, says children who've almost drowned say that, well, they just went underwater and then went to sleep. They don't even really know what's happening. It's that quick.
Anecdotally, we hear reports about that.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then we should say, of course, we just saw a couple of cases where, you know, this is not what happened. Those poor teenagers down in Louisiana were screaming for help and crying for help. And, you know, apparently the men who drowned in Idaho, one was pushed into the water and screamed he couldn't swim. Another jumped in, and then they both were flailing and started to go down. A third jumped in and tried to save them and couldn't. A fourth jumped in with a life preserver. So there was a lot of drama. But more than likely, you're saying what, Francesco Pia, that that's not what we should look for. We should be looking for something very quiet. That means that we should be looking a lot.
That is absolutely correct. And that goes for lifeguards, and that goes for parents who are supervising children at waterfronts.
What should parents be doing that you see them they're not doing?
Well, first of all, parents have to realize that drowning is a leading cause of accidental death and injury for children ages 1 to 4. So in the same way that parents child-proof a home, they need to child-proof their backyard pool if they have one. The height of the fence should be at a minimum of 4 feet. There shouldn't be a space larger than 4 inches in between the fencing. There should be a self-closing, self-latching gate and a child-proof lock. There should be no toys left on the deck of the pool because the toys will serve as an attractant.
You also say parents should use touch-reach supervision, meaning what?
Touch supervision was initially a Canadian concept. Whenever a child is in the water, the parent should be in the water with them within touch supervision, meaning that they can just reach out and touch the child.
You're watching for what, this funny dog paddle?
If they observe their child doing what appears to be a quote-unquote dog paddle or playing around in the water and the child is not moving in any direction, that is a dead giveaway to the parent that the child is in trouble. These struggling arm movements, which are instinctive, which sometimes look like dog paddling, means the child is drowning.
Francesco Pia, an expert on drowning. And Francesco, I heard you stumble over the word dead. I want to ask, what's it like that so many Americans don't know what to look for? But also, what advice do you have? We're going to do that right after a break. Also, when we come back, the trend to closing down backyard pools. That's in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to a tough conversation about drowning. The conventional wisdom that a swimmer in trouble yells for help and flails about like on Baywatch is not the rule. Something our guest, Francesco Pia, proved back in the 60s as a lifeguard at Orchard Beach in the Bronx. With a 16-millimeter camera, he showed that people who are in trouble succumb quickly and quietly. He wasn't listened to at first. Now he is. You can get to his website at oursherenow.org. But, Francesco, I want to ask, you did this project in the 60s. How do you handle the fact that so many Americans still don't know this?
Well, one of my lifeguards described me, and I think very aptly, as a pessimist who was determined to be an optimist. Change is difficult. What has happened is that when people take a look at the films, parents then realize the necessity for continual supervision. With backyard pool drownings, it's not necessarily a lack of supervision on the parents' part, but rather a lapse in supervision. and that lapse is generally 5 minutes or less.
Hmm. Yeah. 20 seconds for a child to drown. There's other video that's been captured on security cameras. One little four-year-old, he's playing with everybody in the pool. He's doing that dog paddle, and then literally within a second, he's face down in the water. 1 second, he just quits. What do lifeguards do, given that 20 seconds? What are you not seeing more of on the chair from lifeguards?
Well, it's a combination of the lifeguards and the supervisors. We entrust 15, 16, and 17-year-olds. They are the difference between a routine rescue and a needless fatality. I always feel that it is the job of the lifeguard supervisor to be out on the deck and to make sure that they are continually scanning and that the lifeguards are given frequent surveillance breaks. You cannot put a human being up on a chair for 2, 3, or 4 hours without a break and expect them to detect a struggle that can last between 20 to 60 seconds.
You say no cell phones, no friends at the lifeguard chair.
Absolutely. And, you know, what was quite disturbing to me was seeing this new phenomenon of lifeguards with smartphones texting and carrying on conversations. There is absolutely no place in lifeguarding for any lifeguard at any time to have his or her personal cell phone with them on the chair and using it.
Francesco Pia, you know, we're about to hear that many parents are closing up backyard pools. As we said, drownings are rare, but they're just too horrible. Have you been hearing that?
I have. There are some pediatricians that feel that the only safe backyard pool is one that is filled with sand.
Francesco Pia, again, a former lifeguard and consultant on drowning prevention. Francesco, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
There are now over 9 million backyard pools in the U.S., and drownings, again, are rare. But still, the Boston Globe reports that according to the federal government, on average, a child a day drowns in a pool. And because of the proliferation of pools, the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission says an estimated 4,400 kids 4 and under are treated for near drownings. That's twice as many as in 2007. And that's too much for many parents. Real estate agents report that families with young children won't even look at a home with a pool. And there's a move to beef up safety requirements. Here in Massachusetts, state law requires that a pool be surrounded by a fence. But a fence around the whole house fills that requirement. And one state representative has filed legislation calling for mandatory measures like alarms that detect pool surface motion. Well, meanwhile, we hear anecdotally about people filling in their pools, as Francesco Pio just said, or closing them down. Alyssa Gordon is from Connecticut. She's the mother of 3 girls, and she made that decision to close the family pool. Alyssa, why'd you shut it down?
We made the decision to close down our pool really in response to feeling as if we were having to be incredibly vigilant, not even so much our own children, but the fact that so many people that we would invite over with their young children who were friends of our children, I think people get the sense that when they're in a social environment around a neighborhood pool, that it's very different than being at, let's say, a public pool where you're expecting lifeguards to watch your children. And there, you forget when you're in that social situation that you still need to be very vigilant.
You've now got your pool, what, empty? Describe your pool. How is it being kept now?
Our pool has always had a lock gate fence around the pool itself, in addition to the fence that we have around our property. But for the last, I would say, almost 4 years now, the pool has also had no water in it and has a cover over it. And in addition, we also have a hose set up to drain any additional rainwater that may fall into the pool. It doesn't take that much water to,
right,
you know, to really create a pool of water on the top of that surface of that cover.
So you decided to take these measures. Did you ever consider what the Consumer Product Safety Commission recommends, not just the fence around the pool, but maybe also backdoor alarms so parents would know when a child is headed outside, or sensors to sound an alarm if someone falls in a pool to make you feel more secure?
Yes, we do not have a sensor in the pool, but we do have back door alarms on all of our back doors. So should a door open, there is a sound that's emitted.
But it still wasn't enough.
Well, I think we are, you know, we're not paranoid people around the water. We're actually sailors. We own a boat.
In fact, you're vacationing on a boat right now.
you're speaking to me on a boat out of Shelter Island, New York, right now. You know, so we are very aware of water safety, and we are very comfortable on the water with our children. However, I have to say, you know, the biggest motivation for looking at closing the pool originally was really had to do with not even so much our own children, because we did feel that we had a sense of vigilance and a sense of layering in terms of the protection. It really had to do with it not being fun to play lifeguard in social settings.
Yeah. That's Alyssa Gordon. She's from Connecticut and made the decision to close up her pool because of concerns about the safety for kids. Alyssa, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And again, we also spoke with drowning expert Francesco Pia. One other thing he said, everyone who owns a pool needs to know CPR. People who drown, especially children, can often be revived. Again, for more, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Still ahead, a story to make you smile. We'll go to the School of Rock. Latest news is next, Here and Now. Tonight's forecast, meteor showers with a chance of brilliant flashes and luminescent streaks. Yes, it's time for the annual viewing of the Perseid meteor shower, and this year's display is expected to be particularly spectacular. Kelly Beattie is a planetary specialist and senior contributing editor at Sky and Telescope magazine, a regular on Here and Now. Kelly, welcome back.
Thanks, Robin. Nice to be here.
And I understand you're way up north in Washington, Maine.
We are. We're here with a camp full of people who are anxiously awaiting the darkness to come so that we can watch for those Perseid meteors.
What a great idea to go camping to see these meteors. But give us the range so we know what to expect. I mean, how many meteors can we possibly see in one of these showers, depending on where we are?
Sure. The first thing you need to know is that you'll see the most if you can stay up past midnight, like 2 or 3 in the morning. But I realize that's a stretch for most people. So if it's late in the evening and you're in a really dark location far from city lights, you might see one per minute if you're looking up into the darkest part of the sky, wherever that is. You need to be away from city lights. If you're stuck in the city, you won't see as many. You might see, maybe 10 an hour, maybe 15 an hour, but you'll still see some. It's because the light pollution makes the faintest ones disappear and not be in view.
Wow. And you say that if you're in, where you are and you can stay up past midnight, you could see as many as 108 an hour. That's like fireworks.
Yeah, relatively speaking, absolutely. You know, meteors happen all the time. We all have seen a shooting star at one time or another. But during this time in August, the Earth is plowing through the debris trail of a comet called Swift-Tuttle, and every August, like clockwork, we plow through that cloud of particles and we get a pulse of meteors that is really wonderful to see.
Wonderful. Well, and why are conditions particularly good this year?
Well, a couple of things. The first is that every now and then we get a little bit of enhancement from the meteors. That we go through little pockets of the trail of debris that are more dense than others, and we have a little bit of that going on. But mostly it's because there's no moon in the sky. In the same way that light pollution washes out the faintest meteors, the moon does too. And right now the moon is not going to be a factor. The skies will be really dark, about as dark as they can get. And so we'll see the most meteors we can.
And by the way, why is it called the Perseids?
Oh, that's a really good question. Why don't we call them the Swift-Tuttleids? It's because these meteors all seem to have a starting point in the sky in the constellation of Perseus. And Perseus doesn't rise over our horizon until about 9 or 10 o'clock. It's in the northeast. So you won't see any meteors in the sky before then. And the later up you can stay, the higher Perseus gets in the sky and the more meteors you'll see.
Okay, so get the kids out there in their PJs. But by the way, we understand before that happens, there's another celestial event you might want to look for involving planets and the little sliver of a moon that there will be earlier.
Yeah, while you're waiting for those Perseids, while you're waiting for it to get dark and later on, if you look over in the west right after sunset, there will be a fingernail-thin sliver of a crescent moon, beautiful in the sky, along with three planets. The brightest one is Venus, and the two above it to either side are Mars and Saturn. It's kind of like a planetary gathering there in the western sky in celebration of these great Perseid meteors.
Kelly Beattie, planetary specialist and Sky and Telescope magazine senior contributing editor, speaking to us from the wilderness of Maine, where he and others are camping out to watch tonight's light display. And by the way, Kelly, just want to say, our apologies in advance if in your part of the country you get clouds.
Oh, no, we're expecting clear skies, and I wish everybody clear skies tonight, Robin.
I know. I just don't want to make it a guarantee. Kelly, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Robin. Take care.
That WikiLeaks leak of thousands of military documents swung a giant spotlight over to MIT. The hacker who tipped off federal officials to Army Specialist Bradley Manning's alleged leak now says that students at MIT told him they worked for WikiLeaks and they gave Manning the software needed to download the classified documents. The New York Times spoke to two MIT students who said they'd been interviewed by the Army, but they denied any connection to the leaks. Now, Manning was said to be frustrated with the military's don't ask, don't tell policy and said to be reaching out to civilian friends. And the Boston Globe did speak to an MIT grad who admitted meeting with Manning and exchanging emails, but he also adamantly denied any connection to the leaks. Still, the MIT campus is buzzing. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology has had a long relationship with the military. During the Cold War, 90% of its research funding came from the Pentagon. But it also has a history of dissent and protest. Tracy Jan covers higher education for the Boston Globe. And Tracy, tell us, what did people on campus tell you about the possibility of a connection between students and this alleged leaker?
Well, right now it's not known who these students are, but many people on campus, professors and students included, were not surprised by the connection. They say MIT is full of bright students. A lot of them have been trained to question authority, question everything in their pursuit of science, and they are not surprised if there is some sort of a link there.
He spoke to the linguist Noam Chomsky, who, of course, is a fiery left-wing questioner of authority, and he's one of those who said to you, this is the culture here.
Absolutely. He says that there is a questioning subculture at MIT, and it's just the nature of the scientific fields that MIT is known for.
Well, but it's also got a long history of working with the military. You write, MIT was the single largest wartime research and development contractor during World War II. So tell us a little more about that history.
MIT's history with the military really ramped up during World War II. It was there that radar technology was developed to shoot down German cruise missiles during the war. And that relationship just continued ever since. There was heavy dependence on the Department of Defense for funding of research. During the Cold War, they designed the nation's air defense and missile guidance system, and that actually helped Apollo land on the moon. And more recently, during the war on terrorism, they've been working with the Army to design better uniforms to better protect them on the battlefield and increase their chances of surviving.
And working with a lot of nanotechnology.
Absolutely. This is uniform that will supposedly, you know, sense that something is wrong and send messages to doctors. And they can, this is the dream, of course, that if an arm is broken, the uniform will harden into a splint.
And so a lot of graduate students are involved in that work. But there's also a history of protest of that kind of work. You write about how in the 60s, students stormed the president's office with a battering ram.
Right. Well, actually, of course, there were protests all over the country at universities in the late 1960s. And at MIT, it wasn't just protesting the war. A lot of the student activists and professors were protesting MIT's very close ties to the military and their funding of the research. So yes, they did storm the president's office with a battering ram. They also held a sit-in or a vigil at the student center for many days to protect an Army deserter.
And you also write they bombed the bathroom at the Center for International Studies, which had just accepted CIA funding. So there was an uproar at MIT, but that did ignite a national debate on the military's influence on university research.
Yes. I mean, it's not just MIT that the military funds. Many universities around the country, Stanford, Johns Hopkins, many universities get funding from the military, and that was a big issue back in the 60s.
Well, and taking a look at another fascinating chapter in history, it's so interesting because today's leak of military papers has been compared to the Pentagon Papers leak, and Daniel Ellsberg, who's the former Hawk, the former RAND researcher who became disenchanted with the Vietnam War that he helped construct, he's the one who leaked those Pentagon papers. He moved here to Cambridge and attended MIT as a fellow when he was in the middle of this whole drama. And you spoke to him. He told you why he chose MIT.
Right. Well, Ellsberg had actually copied the Pentagon Papers while he was at RAND, and he came to MIT having already copied those papers. This was the fall of 1970, basically as a sort of a hideout. He was there as a research fellow. He was working on the paper that was critical of the government's handling of Vietnam. This later won a big prize for papers. And he said he didn't want to be arrested at RAND because he didn't want to embarrass his fellow coworkers. He came to MIT fully expecting to be arrested at any minute. And he actually said, you know, he didn't care if he embarrassed MIT, that they had tremendous war contracts with the Defense Department, and he figured they could just take it.
Yeah. So there's that interesting chapter. And by the way, he has compared Bradley Manning's alleged leaking of military documents to the Pentagon Papers and said that he supports Manning. He doesn't think there's anything that was disclosed that should be an issue. But, you know, there are some people who are saying that there were the names of Afghan aides. There's been no strategy information that came out of these papers, but there certainly were some names that came out that might endanger people. So, again, what's the debate on campus? Did you find students who were embarrassed by this, who felt that it did endanger the country?
Actually, all the students I spoke with, none of them were embarrassed by it. Some of them were actually supporters of what Bradley Manning is alleged to have done. In fact, there's a new Bradley Manning support network that formed, not at MIT, it was formed elsewhere. And more than 400 people have donated. Several dozen of them have actually come from MIT.
Is there a sense, though, from anyone that you've talked to, that it's sort of a little like biting the hand that feeds them? The military sends these, how many millions of dollars to MIT?
Right now, the military sends more than $750 million a year to MIT for on-campus research. This is also including work that is done off-campus at their top-secret Lincoln Laboratory in Lexington. That is about half of all MIT research, and MIT is one of the top five universities being funded by the Department of Defense. Given that it's a university, people say that this is not unexpected. There's always dissent at universities. It's not just unique to MIT, but there's always freedom for different lines of thought. And MIT's vice president, who oversees all of their research, Claude Cananzares, says they should be in the business of helping secure the nation, although they shouldn't be developing offensive weapons. To some people, that's a very fine line.
Tracy Jan covers higher education for the Boston Globe. Tracy, thank you.
Thank you very much.
I heard you in music class. You guys can really play.
Why didn't anyone tell me?
I think it's time we started our new class project.
Rock band.
Can we tell our parents?
No!
That's Jack Black in School of Rock, the 2003 film that spawned who knows how many bands of young rockers.
Together.
Like this group of 10-year-olds, one of seven bands performing recently at a Boston nightclub. They've all come together with the help of a dedicated guitar teacher. And here now George Hicks introduces us to Mike Irwin and two of his bands as they prepare for the show.
What's up, Eamon? Come on in, dude.
Eamon and Jamie are first to arrive. You might think that after being sprung from school, these fifth graders would be perfectly happy in front of a video screen playing Rock Band or Guitar Hero. But these boys really are in a rock band, and they're here at Mike Irwin's apartment to rehearse one last time before their performance.
Are you using distortion today, Mike?
You know it, dude. It's the last rehearsal before the show. Cranking it up.
With his zippered sweatshirt, neatly trimmed beard, and ever-present cups of tea, Mike's got a hip indie rocker meets Mr. Rogers vibe that puts kids and parents at ease. On the first floor of this Victorian-style house, he's converted two rooms into a recording studio and practice room. Everything here is ready to rock, or at least inspire.
Do they get to play all of your instruments?
They do not.
Mike tunes Eamon's bass as bandmates Henry and David arrive. These boys are all 11 or 12 years old. They've been playing together for 3 years, but they took a while to find a band name.
What's the name?
It's debating.
Not dude. No. We have a name.
That wasn't even our name, really.
They're aptly named the Interrupters.
While Mike tunes Henry's guitar, drummer David is showing off the new cast on his right arm, a lacrosse casualty.
Yeah, both the bones broke.
Sound like this.
With a one-armed drummer and their big gig just a few days away, the Interrupters seem pretty relaxed, thanks to Mike.
Well, we're teaming up. I'm going to play the cymbals, and he's going to rock the rest of the kit for the show.
With Mike beside him, David smacks his drumstick on his cast to count off one of the three tunes they'll perform.
Hey, just don't hit it that hard until the show, right? His parents are going to kill me.
So if you don't
This song, Franz Ferdinand's Take Me Out, has several changes of tempo and feel, not something a band this young could get through on their own.
It's tough because I try and push them all the time with new stuff that's a little bit hard for them, so they keep getting better, you know.
And Mike says his bands get better surprisingly fast.
I'll often find myself teaching them at one level and then just suddenly realize, like, whoa, we can totally take it up a notch. Take Me Out, that song is all, everybody plays different parts and they all harmonize, you know. A couple years ago we were just concentrating on playing a G chord all together.
Mike is patient, a distinct advantage when dealing with bands like the Interrupters. It's a virtue born out of necessity.
When I started out, nobody was coaching or anything like that. I just wanted to have a band with my buddies. And we would just get together once a week in my parents' basement, and it was awful in the beginning.
Growing up in Western Massachusetts, Mike studied piano and trumpet until succumbing at 13 to the power of rock.
Getting girls? Yeah, guitar was a lot cooler, for sure. And I was super into Guns N' Roses. I got made fun of a little bit for being obsessed with Guns N' Roses.
Musical tastes aside, Mike's parents were supportive, and their teenage rocker realized that making music and making a living were not synonymous. But at 20, Mike ditched college and moved to Boston to play and teach. His role model was his own guitar teacher, who was in an Ozzy Osbourne tribute band.
I definitely noticed that. I mean, it seemed like he would just roll into the music shop around 2 and play guitar with kids and then play in the band at night, you know? I mean, it seemed like he had a great lifestyle, which he did, because I have the same one right now, and it's great.
11 years later, he's still playing original music in 3 groups of his own. He has 38 guitar and bass students, mostly school age, and he's coaching 7 bands of 9 to 15-year-olds.
These rehearsals aren't much different from the ones that I have with my bands. I think I have the same amount of fun in these kids' rehearsals that I do in my own bands, too. I mean, when it finally clicks, it's a great feeling.
All right, guys, you're free. Nice job, man.
After the Interrupters have run through their set a couple of times, the next band arrives. A little older, a little less experienced, and all female.
Hi, Franny. Can I hug you?
Yes.
My Franny Bear!
Franny is the lead singer of No Mascara. Franny, Daisy, Rachel, Kate, and Charlotte are working on an original called The Best Song Ever. It's meant to be an ironic and self-deprecating take on the difficulty of songwriting.
We don't know what to say. Words anyway.
Franny's forgetting some of the words, Rachel's sometimes in the wrong key, and Daisy's unsure where her guitar breaks are. But Mike is here to help. At his own peril.
Was that the right number of times through?
It's a little bit awkward.
Kind of you're not listening, yeah. Mike. We stop at the end and she sings
the last line times. By herself.
And he does the fifth by herself.
You're all smarter than me.
You're not listening.
Right for the quick down. That's tough.
I try to interact with these kids on a level of being their friends. I mean, I'm a teacher for sure, but I'd rather sort of integrate myself into how they interact. When I'm at a loss, they catch that pretty quick, and they're happy to point it out and make fun of me a bit, which is fine. So they keep me plenty sharp.
Climbing way out on a limb of my own, I ask Mike if the girls rock the same as the boys.
Oh, they can rock, definitely, in the same way as the boys can. I don't think there's any difference there.
Here's the proof.
Come on, Rick! I'm not a child! I know my own worth!
No Mascara, playing to a packed house at the Middlesex Tavern. They sound good, and they are wearing eye makeup. But anyway, the audience is over 100 strong, families and friends of the 7 bands performing, plus a large crowd who stopped to peer in the windows from the sidewalk. Mike is MC, roadie, sound man, and stage manager, tuning each band's guitars between sets. As No Mascara finishes, he looks as blissed out as if he himself were performing. The Interrupters are on next. Waiting for Mike to finish setting up their gear, Henry, Eamon, and David are as nonchalant as ever.
Dude, do you think me or him have better shoes?
I think I have better shoes than both of you.
Mike delivers a pep talk before the musicians hit the stage.
Here it goes.
I'm going to destroy this place. I'm super experienced now, man. I want to hear some huge noise out of you, okay?
We want to hear some huge laughs and a good idea.
Yeah. All right, you guys ready?
Mike, let's go.
Many of the other bands are considerably more keyed up about performing, and it's fair to say a lot of their parents are pretty amped as well. Throughout the show, the atmosphere is raucous and supportive, but Mike says it's not like a Little League tournament.
And music is art. It's not a sport. And I really try and play down the competitiveness. It's not about being better than the other guy. It's about just doing something awesome.
And Mike Irwin and his bands say they're experiencing something they can't get any other way.
There's something about playing music with people on a regular basis that really brings them together in a really amazing way. And it's really fun to be a part of that with all these kids.
Yeah, yeah, it's fun. I'm just always, like, totally bonding about playing.
You know, like, everybody loves you.
You stand on stage with everybody, and you're playing music that you like, and you get all happy.
Yeah, then you get the adrenaline.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Our story was produced by Here and Now's George Hicks. You can see pictures and hear more of Mike Irwin's bands at our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now. I'm a human being.